Our first speaker today is Rob Bamberg. We've become acquainted with Rob from his presentations at our last two conferences about the Recorded Sound Preservation Study. Now that the study is virtually wrapped up, Rob wanted to give a presentation that will make no references to copyright or metadata. We all share in his joy. For nearly 30 years, Rob has produced and hosted a weekly program on public radio affiliate WAMU-FM here in Washington, D.C. It's called Hot Jazz Saturday Night and is devoted to in the main to pre-World War II jazz and popular music. The program, syndicated internationally by NPR worldwide, is well-respected because Rob quotes Dan Morgenstern a lot. Over the years, Rob has written notes to releases from the Smithsonian Collection of Recordings and a number of other labels. His talk today is about Hoagy Carmichael and Beeks Beiderbecke. He has given it the title, The Seeds of Harvestry, which Rob explained to me is a literary quotation that he could never have thought up on his own. Here's Rob Bamberger.
Thank you, Marlon. This was a tough choice this morning to come here as opposed to listen to Doug Benson. He does phenomenal work, and my great comfort is that since the proceedings will be eventually online, I'm sure we'll all want to hear what Doug says. I had a chance to hear some work in progress on one of the records that Bix made with the Wolverines, and there was so much new detail that I could hear, it was almost like listening to an alternate take. He's quite phenomenal. I apologize. I probably am not going to be as slick as I'd like to be this morning. The dilemma is when I got home last night, I wanted to try playing my bag. And for those who deal with such things, let me advise you, you're going to need a 1.2 mil stylus because it's very tightly woven. And it's 32.9 RPM. And what you will hear is an album called Sam Sings Sondheim with a beat. But one thing torqued me, and that was my bag is out of round. So check yours carefully. I want to share with you a story of Bix Beiderbecke and his relationship with Hoagy Carmichael, the composer of a number of terrific songs that we all know, including one that will be part of our focus, Stardust, but there's, of course, Georgia on My Mind, Two Sleepy People, Memphis in June, Rockin' Chair, and many other widely recognized ones. Carmichael had a full life. He was born in 1899 and lived into his early 80s. He died in late December of 1981. Bix, by comparison, had a very short life. He died in August of 1931, and he was only 28. They had periodic contact with one another up until the time that Bix died. But what's crucial to us today are roughly 4 to 5 weeks that they spent together in Bloomington during the spring of 1924, when the band that Bix was with, the Wolverines, was playing and recording in the area. The story here is about their friendship and their interaction. During those weeks in 1924, it may have left an indelible mark on Carmichael's music. It's also a story about the sort of cross-fertilization that occurs all the time between different types of music. I imagine that the two figures at the center of this, songwriter Hoagy Carmichael on the right and Bix on the left, the jazz cornetist who looms so large in inverse proportion to the length of his life, I imagine they both have some recognition with everyone here, but to put everyone on a level playing field, I'll speak briefly about the background of each as we go along, even though it may be turf with which some of you are already quite familiar. About 5 years ago, music written by or associated with Carmichael and Beiderbecke were included in a concert staged by a Washington choral group, a concert that they titled Jazz Meets Classical, Reflections from the Third Stream. As I say, Bix and Hoagy were part of the concert program, underscoring that the so-called third stream may have held Vic Spiderbeck in a fairly tight grip, that these were not passive influences but passionate ones, and that during these few weeks in 1924 when Bix and Hoagy spent some concentrated time together, they shared, they discussed, they experienced some of this music together. Now, I have to acknowledge, not out of pedantry, but because I know to whom I'm speaking, that the term third stream wasn't coined until the 1950s when composer Gunther Schuller used it to describe his own music, which fuses elements of classical music with jazz. However, we also know that when someone mentions, for example, Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys, we all go, oh yeah, Texas swing, Western swing. But this was a term that didn't come into usage until a decade or so after Milton Brown and Bob Wills first recorded what is recognized as Western swing. Still, can we make an application of third stream to Beiderbecke? Well, when faced with these kinds of interpretive dilemmas, I always share my problem with the Yoda of musicologists, Dick Spotswood. And talking about this with Dick, some years ago, he tossed off one of those casual Spotswoodian gems that make one long for a grant to underwrite the expense of having a Boswell just trailing after Richard, taking down these profundities that he tosses off so unpretentiously. On this occasion, Dick said that musical styles don't take on a name until they need it, and they don't need it until they've been kicking around for a while. So, except, if you will, that we can relate the idea, the concept of third stream to Bix in a descriptive sense, not as an historical development. Dick says so. That's generally good enough for me. Probably good enough for you, with the possible exception of Steve Smolian. I've got a working model of a Steve Smolian bobblehead. It goes... Well, what then about the melding of elements from classical music and jazz? Let's not get hung up in the old high culture, low culture battle, as if a symphony owns a house and is horrified to learn that a pop song has moved in next door. Musical traditions have mixed for centuries, many symphonies borrowing from folk or traditional themes native to a composer's country. We needn't even be conscious of cross-pollination where it occurs, and that's kind of what's sort of neat about it. It can be very present without being noticeably apparent. One of the most important influences on Bix Beiderbecke during the 1920s was the music of the French Impressionists, Ravel, Debussy, and the music of some American counterparts, Eastwood Lane and Edward McDowell. Beiderbecke felt a lot of passion for the music of these composers, and when he spent time with Hoagy in 1924, my argument is these seeds were very clearly passed along. Now, it's difficult to encapsulate the life of these two in the time at our disposal. If Bix is not familiar to you, well, someone in similar circumstances once remarked that it appeared to him that Bix was the Elvis of the hot jazz world. It's true in a sense. If you return home and approach your Department of Motor Vehicles for a vanity plate that says Bix lives, you will probably find it's gone. The same probably couldn't be said for Satchmo lives or Ornette lives, but then those are probably too long for a license plate anyway. So I haven't really proven anything here. So it's a darn good thing that I brought something along that captures the aura that surrounds Bix Beiderbecke. An aura that you will hear almost goes begging for words. It's a brief excerpt from an interview with cornetist Jimmy McPartland that he had with Voice of America broadcaster Willis Conover. When Bix left a band called the Wolverines in 1924, it was McPartland who replaced him, who shared a room with Bix for a week while he learned the band's repertoire. He might have just as well spent the week with God when he created heaven and earth. Although McPartland would have probably said it would be better to spend a week with Bix. So here is that recollection from Jimmy McPartland.
How often had you heard Bix Beiderbecke play before you took his spot with the Wolverines?
I had never heard him play in person before that time, outside of his recordings that they had made with the Wolverines on the old Jeanette Records. So the first time I ever heard him was actually when I sat in with the band, and he worked with the band for one full week to show me the arrangements, because they were all, as we call, head arrangements. Nothing was written down, and he would just show me the notes on the cornet, and actually I roomed with him for this one week. We lived together at the Somerset Hotel in New York City and played with the band, and it was a wonderful kick for me because he was my idol in those days, and actually he still is. I mean, for his fine feeling of music and his tone and his, well, I don't know, just Bix Beiderbecke.
I've always found that very moving to listen to at the end. Words do seem to fail McPartland. Well, when we think of jazz, one of the prominent images planted in our heads is that of a musician soloing. It's not easy to solo. Dave Robinson will probably attest to that. You have to be able to think ahead a few measures. The solo needs to have structure if it's going to build to any sort of climax. It's no easy thing. Beiderbecke and Louis Armstrong are regarded as musicians who were the first to display that skill, to be able to construct solos that told some sort of story and could sweep you up in the moment. I will add as a footnote that I think clarinetist and soprano saxophonist Sidney Bechet would also be counted among them. He chose to leave the United States. He had recorded, of course, in 1923, but then he left the United States and went unrecorded in Europe. I think if there was a larger discographical trail of Bechet, he would probably be counted as one of a threesome. Bix, Louis, and Sidney emerge on recordings about the same time, but where Armstrong and Bechet have a solo style built partly on the blues and with a very fierce attack, Beiderbecke has something different going on in his head. His improvisations derive more from melody. There's heat, but it's of a different sort. Here's a medley drawn from three different Beiderbecke performances. The first one dates from this period that we'll be talking about, when Bix and Hoagie were together, when the Wolverines went to Richmond, Indiana to record a tune that Hoagie had placed in their hands, originally called Freewheeling, and Hoagie was not present for the recording session. Bix and the band decided to name it Riverboat Shuffle. So we'll hear an excerpt from that with Bix's solo, then one from his tenure with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra, an excerpt from Changes, and the last is one of the Beiderbecke solos that has become sacred text, his solo from Singin' the Blues, to which we will be returning as we go along. To those who know these records, there'll be a couple of places during the course of the presentation where there will be an edit that might jar you, so I will warn you about that. Let's listen to that medley. Thank you. Well, if you've not heard Bix, that gives you a good approximation. I want to be sure I identified the Whiteman recording correctly. I hope I said Lonely Melody. That's what I thought. I'm changing it to Lonely Melody. I knew that wasn't right. So where does that sound and style come from? I think we know that any musician or singer who creates a distinctive or model-setting style has a basket full of influences of various sorts, whether it's music heard in the home, on a street corner, in a place of religious worship, pouring from an open window. And this basket of influences fuses or is distilled through whatever original concepts that person hears inside his or her head. But then what gets expressed in sound is further shaped by physical characteristics and whatever the extent or absence there may be of technique. It's impossible to assign percentages, I imagine, to these various categories or within them, but we can try to at least recognize and identify them. One thing that is apparent but hardly unique to Bix is that there are influences upon him that, unlike the general perception of jazz, that I would say were more salon than saloon, we're perhaps better able to understand that and what informs the cornet if we consider Bix Beiderbecke also as a pianist. More than a decade before he took up the cornet, we know that he showed a remarkable ear. He was picking out melodies at the piano after hearing them once, eventually providing rudimentary left-hand accompaniments as well. People who knew him often saw him seated at the piano. Now, as I noted, he was attracted to French Impressionist composers whose music used whole tone scales, parallel harmonies, extended chords that sometimes took advantage of the ninth and 13th notes of the scale. Many of the compositions by the Impressionists were just that, musical impressions of visuals, scenes often out of nature or dusted with fantasy. Just to establish the whole tone scale, let's listen to the scale we all know, followed by the whole tone scale. And very much missed Richard Sudhalter explored and meditated on the life and music of Bix Beiderbecke for more than 30 years, and for many of these years on Hoagy Carmichael too. He once wrote that there was a significant vein of efforts during the 1920s to express the emergent jazz language in compositional terms. There's certainly plenty of examples of jazz feeling being interpolated into compositional works. Of course, Rhapsody in Blue becomes one of the most obvious examples. Indeed, the theme of the concert where it was premiered, a Paul Whiteman event, was intended to demonstrate that jazz could be respectable if you took the barnyard elements out of it and kind of taught it manners. However, apparently the crowd loved Whiteman's demonstration of what the original Dixieland jazz band had sounded like. There are also many instances of composers and arrangers in the jazz realm experimenting with more tightly constructed original works that are still represented as jazz because they have that feeling. Toward the end of 1923, the Wolverines were playing the Stockton Club in Hamilton, Ohio. Bix wandered into a local music store and saw a notice there, a woman named Priscilla Holbrook, who was offering piano lessons. He took some lessons with her, and it was from her that he first learned of a contemporary American composer named Eastwood Lane, born in 1879, but who didn't begin writing music until the mid-1910s. He, in turn, had been influenced by Edward McDowell, a composer who had died in 1908. McDowell had been head of the music department at Columbia from 1896 to 1904. McDowell periodically retreated to a farm he had acquired in New Hampshire, and it was there that he composed his best-known music, a collection of melodies called The Woodland Sketches. Eastwood Lane also wrote piano miniatures with what one pianist has described as a wistful, meditative vision. and Lane titled one set of these miniatures the Adirondack Sketches, in a nod to McDowell. Lane lived most of his life in Greenwich Village. He worked for a music publisher. He was friends with members of the Algonquin Round Table. Bix would pay, over time, several visits to Lane, and Lane's widow later recalled that Bix would insist that Lane play for him, and sometimes for hours, and Lane would play the Adirondack Sketches. One of them was a favorite of Beiderbecke, and that was The Land of the Loon. Here's an excerpt. Often of ear witnesses who remember Bix playing piano, and they comment on the individuality of what he was doing. A show performer, Dorothy McNulty, who was in her mid-90s when she died in 2004, had a marvelous memory of Bix in New York in the 1920s. In an interview conducted a few years before her death, she recalled, "Bix frequently played piano in an after-hours speakeasy on 52nd Street and Fifth Avenue. Sometimes he sat in with the other musicians, but mostly he played piano during intermissions. Everybody knew Bix, and we all listened mesmerized by his music." McNulty later had the good sense to change her name to Penny Singleton. After appearing as Blondie in nearly 30 low-budget movies from 1938 to 1950, she should have had the good sense to change it back to McNulty. Bix had four piano compositions published before his death, the titles All of a Theme, In a Mist, In the Dark, Flashes, and Candlelights. And though there are a few other recordings on which Bix may be heard at the piano, In a Mist is the only one of these four solo pieces that he would himself record. And owing to the fact that, as you well know, the length of a 78 RPM 10-inch record is going to come in around 3 minutes, Bix had to play In a Mist at a somewhat brisker tempo than I think was probably the norm in performance. It's an important record to hear, and we hear an excerpt from it.
Thank you.
So in a mist, we're hearing this distillation of different influences upon Bix, distilled through his own musical sensibilities to create something entirely his own. So now we should pick up the trail with Hoagie Carmichael, and here I think the trail gets really interesting. Bix was born in Davenport, Iowa. Carmichael, too, was from the Midwest, and a ruminative-sounding pianist at the Keys, born in Bloomington, Indiana in 1899. His mother was a pianist when silent films came to town. She was down front providing the musical accompaniment. His interest in the piano was kindled in 1906. We learn that early that year, the Bells had arrived in Bloomington to be installed in a clock tower atop the new Student Union building on the campus at Indiana University. Every weekday afternoon, the Bells tolled the school's alma mater, Hail to Old IU, and Hoagie picked out the melody at the piano, studying the relationship between the notes. When he was enrolled at or living around the campus of IU, there was an off-campus establishment called the Book Nook, where he often sat at the piano. In the spring of 1924, Hoagie got a letter from a friend, a tenor saxophonist named George Johnson, who was playing with Bix and the Wolverines. And the thrust of the letter was whether Hoagie could rustle up a job or two for the band around Bloomington or Indiana University. Carmichael arranged an engagement at the Indiana University Boosters Club, and during the warm-up at the Kappa Sig House, Hoagie sat in at the piano. Hoagie probably had heard him before, but in some of his memoirs positions this as the first time. Bix began to play, and this is the occasion that inspired the famous comment by Carmichael, "Just four notes, but he didn't blow them. He hit them like a mallet hits a chime. His tone had a richness that can only come from the heart. I rose violently from the piano bench and fell, exhausted, onto a Davenport. He had completely ruined me. That sounds idiotic, but it is the truth." Probably not exactly the truth. But I quote it in its entirety to make clear, even if it is embroidered, the impact that Beiderbecke had on Hoagie. It's a few weeks later that the band repairs to Richmond, Indiana to record the Riverboat Shuffle. They come back to Bloomington. Bix and Hoagie hang out for another few weeks. Carmichael recalled lying around listening to the Firebird Suite and other contemporary music. He recalled that thusly, "The music filled us both, I sensed, with terrible longing, dreadful urges, wonderful desires, coupled with white mule liquor. It was strangely moving. It made us very close, and it made us lonely, too, but with a feeling of release, a feeling of elation and ecstasy. You don't forget such a mood. They only come a few times in a lifetime." Carmichael listened attentively when Bix played piano. "Bix didn't copy Ravel," Hoagie wrote years later, "but I recognized a slight similarity in style in the phrases he used, either at the piano or on the cornet." This is the longest period of concentrated time that Carmichael and Beiderbecke ever spent. The band left Bloomington for an engagement outside of Indianapolis in early May, and Hoagie was there, so he must have trailed along. They would cross paths frequently, sometimes travel in similar musical circles, but these weeks, I would argue, are crucial to one dimension of Beiderbecke's legacy and to much of Carmichael's posterity. Had they not spent these weeks together, I wonder if Hoagie Carmichael might not have left behind a somewhat different body of songs. On one of these occasions, I have wondered whether Hoagie and Bix were lying about listening to music together. Did they talk about Edward McDowell? It's likely that Carmichael already knew about him because his Woodland Sketches included a melody that was immensely popular and which you will doubtless recognize, "To a Wild Rose."
Thank you.
Listen now to an excerpt from a record Hoagy Carmichael made in 1928 of Walkin' the Dog, a song written by Shelton Brooks in 1916. Hoagy had also taken up cornet after meeting Bix. You'll hear him briefly on that instrument, playing a few Bix-like notes. Then he sets his horn down quickly, plays a couple of chords at the piano, launches into a scat vocal, followed by a few more piano chords. It's the piano chords on each end of the scat vocal that you should pay attention to. Hoagy stops to smell the roses. Here's another segment from the record. Carmichael followed up Riverboat Shuffle with a song that reveals these influences taking deeper root. Richard Sudhalter observed of one of these, the Boneyard Shuffle, that it bristles with little modernistic touches, whole tone scales, unexpected chordal turns, irregular thematic structures, little in the output of either White or Black bands of 1925 compares with the way of making the unconventional seem perfectly natural. Here's a bit of Boneyard Shuffle. Was recorded that day, the references to Curtis Hitch. The other title recorded that day, which is also interesting, is the Washboard Blues. We won't have time to get into that. We'll omit that because of considerations of time, but that is another one to merit your attention. One of Hoagy Carmichael's later songs was Skylark. It originally was titled Bix's Licks, intended for a 1939 Broadway production. At tempos that allow for a ballad style of playing jazz, Bix often used something that he himself called correlative phrasing, a system of playing conjoined phrases. What this meant is one phrase is followed by another that harks back to the first and will be alluded to or referenced in the third phrase, which also resolves the sequence. Let's listen again to the opening solo, the opening bars of the solo of Singing the Blues. All right, now let's break that down into phrases. The first. The second. And the third. And let's listen to the beginning of Hoagy's melody, Blue Orchids, from 1940. Second. The influences that Bix, I think, had on Hoagy once reminded me of a line from a poem by François Villon, and lest my quoting Villon raises your opinion of me on false grounds, you have to be told that the only reason I know anything of François Villon's poetry is because Ronald Colman plays Villon in a 1938 fictionalized film scripted by Preston Sturges, If I Were King with a Divinely Gorgeous Miss Frances D. And this particular couplet I'm about to cite to you was used by Robert Sherwood in his play The Petrified Forest, which wound up being filmed with Betty Davis and Humphrey Bogart in 1935. So you see, my entire education was learned from Paramount and Warner Brothers. Indeed, these lines are used in Sherwood's play, as I use them here, to capture the relationship musically between Bix and Hoagy. But it is Bix's voice that I hear speaking of Carmichael. Thus in your field my seed of harvestry thrives, for the fruit is like me that I set. And perhaps this is never more so than when we come to Stardust, which many have argued is pure Bix, especially in the haunting verse. When it came to writing a memoir about the genesis of Stardust, Hoagy kept changing the story. One of them was, it was a hot night, sweet with the death of summer and the hint and promise of fall, a waiting night, a night marking time, the end of a season. The stars were bright, close to me, and the North Star hung low over the trees. I looked up at the sky and whistled Stardust. Uh-uh. We know that it was coming together in Hoagy's mind in 1926, though still in 1927, dabbling in the law, Carmichael was deciding whether he was going to go into music. He'd made friends with a pianist and band leader named Emil Seidel, to whom he passed along Stardust, and it was with Seidel's orchestra, with Hoagy at the piano, not in that picture, that is Seidel's orchestra, that the first recording of Stardust was made on October 31st of 1927. In the interest of time, I've cut the melody chorus. You'll hear the statement of the song's verse, followed by Hoagy's solo, and a striking clarinet counter melody that takes the record to its close. Thank you. I'm not a musicologist. I can't diagram it, but I hear a lot of Bix in that, and especially in Hoagy's piano solo. So we've traced some of the influences on Bix himself, how those influences joined in his head, and then I've tried to make a case that all of this was a major agent in Carmichael as well. Carmichael, of course, to the extent that Bix was a mentor, lost him in 1931. You may well know the story. Bix was an alcoholic. He had even absorbed so much poorly made prohibition alcohol that he had developed a peripheral neuropathy that necessitated his using a cane at times. A tale of a mugging was invented to account for this limp. It seems that Bix did not want a visible symptom of his abuse of alcohol to color how people saw him. He did actually achieve some periods of sobriety longer than for which he's been given credit. But by the late 20s, he was beginning to fail. His playing was beginning to fail, but I would express it just a little differently. As his dependence on alcohol grew, Bix began to fail his music. Because that's how I think it felt for him internally. He was failing the music, and I think it fueled his spiral. Paul Whiteman, in whose orchestra he was at the time, sent Bix off at full pay to take what was then the only treatment for alcoholism, the cure, not much more than monitored withdrawal, rest, regular meals, and encouragement. But Bix also had pneumonias, and I think these pneumonias sometimes receded but were always there and kind of eating away at his constitution. He would die of pneumonia in a stifling apartment in Queens in August of 1931, age 28, his last moments a hallucinatory fit of DTs. One of the last record dates on which he participated about a year before his death was led by the man he had deeply influenced, Hoagy Carmichael. Bix's early death invited myth, one of the most persistent, which I found expressed as recently in the Ken Burns documentary, was that it was Bix being creatively stifled in the elephantine ranks of the Paul Whiteman Orchestra that drove him more deeply into the alcoholism that killed him, that his jazz instincts were suppressed. Actually, it's been widely accepted for a long time that Bix was terrifically proud to be part of the Whiteman Orchestra. And I would go further than that. I would say it was altogether redemptive for him, and that his depression and shame were intensified by his inability to return to the Whiteman band. In this sense, it may not have been the unsatisfied longings of his jazz soul that killed Bix Beiderbecke, as the myth maintains, for it seems clear that there was something unrequited for him from the third stream as well. The evidence may have been there all along, but just smothered by some of these conventional wisdoms that were not right. Ralph Burton, who spent the summer of 1923 with Bix and the Wolverines, his brother Vic was in the band. Ralph would write 40 years later, "I did feel even then and more surely now that what Bix wanted from music, jazz never truly gave him, and that his fumbling overtures to classical music were an indication that he hoped to find it there." As for Hoagy Carmichael, asked in 1979 about the first time he heard Bix, to confirm his recollections, he remembered these four notes and said, "It's just that those few notes sounded like something I might have been waiting for, searching for, all my life, without even knowing that they were what I was after." Hoagy over-emoting again? Perhaps, but there's some truth in it. Because whatever was left unfinished by Bix himself in the realm of cornet or piano, jazz or classical, it isn't foolish to say after the fact that Bix does indeed live. Perhaps every time that Blue Orchids or Skylark or Stardust plays, and when we hear some of that music, we might think of Bix as much of the composer Hoagy Carmichael and recall those words of Villon: "Thus in your field, my seed of harvestry thrives, for the fruit is like me that I set." Thank you for your kind attention.